Hi, this is Steve. Act 1 of Lawrence of Arabia ends with T.E. Lawrence in triumph. He has captured Aqaba with a small force against impossible odds, crossed the Sinai Desert to report to General Allenby in Cairo, who promotes him, giving him the respect and responsibilities he always wanted. But rather than heal Lawrence, these triumphs serve only to drive him harder. And as the pressure mounts, the cracks within his character threaten to break him and the Arab revolt apart. T.E. Lawrence was without question a great man, but that greatness didn't come without a great price. And just as Arabia is forever changed by the actions of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence is forever changed by Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia is one of the great cinematic masterpieces, and a must-have for any movie collection. And if you want to build that collection, a great place to start is our website, cinephiles.net, where you can buy Lawrence and every other movie we've ever reviewed. So, that's Act 2 of Lawrence of Arabia with our special guest, Rachel Cushing, this Friday on The Cinephiles.
I shall want quite a lot of money.
All that is. Not that much.
The best of them won't come for money. They'll come for me.
Welcome back to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, and this week we continue our exploration of Lawrence of Arabia. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Aqaba! 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 That's a little, what do you call it? Combining two movies in one. They're a little dog day afternoon in Lawrence. Hi, this is John Rocha. I'm a voiceover artist, host, writer, producer, all kinds of things. And the Outlaw and the Schmodown here in Los Angeles. There we go.
And we are thrilled to welcome back to continue with Lawrence of Arabia, Rachel Cushing. Welcome back to The Cinephiles.
Thank you for having me back. I'm happy to finish out the movie that we started over our very lengthy first discussion.
Yeah. Well, and fortunately, the second half of Lawrence of Arabia is not quite as long as the first half of Lawrence of Arabia. So we're going to just get right in it, I think. We come back considering what a big movie this is and kind of a small scene, which is an American reporter named Bentley shows up at Aqaba to meet Prince Faisal.
The great Arthur Kennedy.
Yeah.
I love him so much as an actor.
And he's great in this movie.
He really leans into the Americanness of this character, I find a lot. But I think that that's an interesting because we've been so established. You know, we've got the British, we've got the Arabs, and then we have this sort of brash, loud reporter type coming in who's intent on making a name for himself as a storyteller, and so he's looking for the subject that that he can tell a story about, make a myth about, and Lawrence is ripe for that kind of exposure.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he's one of these people that I think there's three people in the movie who kind of both admire Lawrence, but also see through them, and that's Allenby, Faisal, and Bentley. Like, they get him.
Yep. Dryden, too.
Yeah,
I would say.
Yeah,
to an extent.
He's so restrained, it's hard to tell.
But I think I mean, I think that there is some respect there. I think the three you mentioned are more like the respect and the distaste for is a little more equal.
Yeah,
in some ways. But
so he goes to have his meeting with Faisal. First thing Faisal does, I love that he puts his watch out.
Yeah,
it's a very small but a really great detail. And there's this conversation of Lawrence's army. He's like, or is it Faisal's army?
He's pushing buttons.
Yeah, definitely. And we get a little, find out that they did not, in fact, get artillery.
Yeah.
And it restrains them to smaller things. And I love that Bentley gives him a little warning of watch out for Allenby. He's a slim customer.
Yeah.
The scene is, it's a fun scene. I think part of you've been through so much emotional stuff and you were just outside and you had your smoke or you had your drink or whatever you had. You went to the bathroom. Now you've come back in. We're not going to jump in that full.
Yeah.
We're going to ease you back into this thing. And then Faisal points out something really important that he gives some statistics, which is we have 37 wounded and 156 dead.
You remark the disproportion between our dead and wounded.
Yeah. Four times as many.
That's because those too badly wounded to bring away, we ourselves kill. We leave no wounded for the Turks.
You mean?
I mean we leave no wounded for the Turks.
Which is, it's foreshadowing for a plot point, but it's also a very interesting and sort of telling way to position this as it is a war. People are dying, and that the circumstances of this war are even that much worse because the people that we're fighting do not look at us as human beings, do not obey the Geneva Convention, and will not treat any prisoners of war, you know, gently. Yeah. And so you sort of get a little bit of a wake-up call of, yeah, this is a war. And not a fun one.
They have a fascinatingly honest conversation, I think. Like, each one of them knows, like, oh, I'm saying this for this reason. Oh, I see that you're saying this, and this is what's behind it. Mm-hmm. And they both kind of understand each other. And we hear that what Bentley wants is his story to tell. Mm-hmm. And even describes that he's looking for a hero that can make the war seem adventurous.
Right, because this was about the time that the Americans were, you know, finally convinced to join the war. Mm-hmm. And the way to get Americans behind war is through propaganda. And wouldn't it be fun and nice to join this war? If only they knew what was coming.
Right.
But I like that the movie doesn't shy away from that sort of less than ethical reasoning for what he's trying to do. But I think he recognizes that Faisal is somebody who isn't going to necessarily mince words and understand the true motivations for characters.
It's very simple, sir. I'm looking for a hero.
Indeed. You do not seem a romantic man.
Oh, no. But certain influential men back home believe that the time has come for America to lend her weight to the patriotic struggle against Germany and Turkey. Now, I've been sent to find material which will show our people that this war is...
enjoyable?
Well, hardly that, sir. But to show it in its more adventurous aspects.
You are looking for a figure who will draw your country towards war.
All right. Yes.
Ahrens is your man.
Again, an amazing cut to a beautiful shot of Peter O'Toole holding up the plunger on a, you know, explosive device and blowing up that train. It's just so gorgeous. It's just, again, I have another note. The pictures are amazing. They fire the chain from the distance, and this almost looks like an army. Like, we have people, mm-hmm. they're behind cover, they're firing from a distance. Lawrence yells at them to stop. They don't stop. Yep. Lawrence fires a flare. They don't stop. Lawrence runs out, fires a flare again. They don't stop. Auda says stop. They stop. And then they charge down at the train. And how do you feel about this attack on the train?
It's brutal.
Yeah.
But I also think Lawrence has converted into the Arab thinking, Arab approach to these kinds of things, where he removes the morality of it or the judgment of it, and he participates in it. But he's also swept up. He's working through some shit, and he's swept up in this savior prophet type of thing. And you see when they attack the train and the way they shoot everybody and the people like leaning out the windows and stuff, and they take all this, and you see him walking on top of the train. There's all of it that happens here that is very graphic.
And to be clear, this is not solely a military train.
Right.
Right.
There are civilians, there's old men, there's just normal people on this train, and they just wipe them all out.
Yeah.
And as Lawrence is kind of going through there, and while they're looting the train for stuff, we see a wounded soldier that's kind of struggling to his feet.
Yeah.
And Alda goes by with an umbrella.
just because.
And the wounded soldier spots Lawrence and shoots him in the shoulder.
He's parading on top of the train.
Yeah.
That's the thing. He makes himself a target by being like that in his old white clean robes again.
Yep.
He's playing up the mythical leader figure, the one who nothing can happen to
me.
Yes.
Yep.
The idea that he
nothing bad can happen to me.
But something bad does happen to him because he gets shot in the shoulder. He goes down, and his first words I find so fascinating. He says, good, good. What do you think he means by that?
I feel like it's the dichotomy of coming to it. So before, soldiers going into war have a romanticized version of it. Now you're in the thick of it. Now you're dealing with the reality of it. And now he's understanding that the looting and the killing of innocents, and he gets swept up in it. And that's, you know, part of it. But as much as he wants to be the mythic figure and the prophet, he needs to feel grounded in a way with it too. And so, like, I take it as of, like, you know, the enemy fights back, but not in a way that it's like that treading that line of I'm invincible. You got me in the shoulder,
mm-hmm.
and I'm standing up. And I think there's almost like a respect he has for that guy for taking that shot in a way. But it, to me, also, though, the more interesting thing is he says that and then he stands there and lets him shoot at him however many more times.
Yeah.
So it's really this weird, I'm this extraordinary figure that cannot be killed. And I'm proving that right now, but just fallible enough to have been grazed, I guess.
Well, it's, yeah, I think it's such a complicated moment.
Yeah.
And I think there's part of it to me is this sort of, first of all, he's never been shot before. So now I've had this experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now I know what this thing is. I was afraid of this and now I've experienced.
Yeah. He's understanding what it actually, war actually means now. It's not this.
And then it's also like, I had this thought, because it's, some moments just make you sort of dig into them and go, like, well, what is that about? Mm-hmm. And I also kind of had the thought of like, oh, I've gotten too big for my britches. I was believing my own BS. Mm-hmm. And now, good. I've something reminded me of this. And then also I think maybe there's a, and now I'm afraid, like I'm feeling real fear. And therefore, what do I have to do? I have to not mind that it hurts and I have to stand up and face it.
Hmm.
And allow myself to be, you know, there's all these things going on
here. I love that you made the callback to the burning of the fingers, not minding the hurt, you know, the pain. It's the trick is to ignore the pain.
This is a thing that we're going to see a lot.
I do want to know for another possibility.
Yes. Because
for my mind, it's, I've always took it as a psychological moment for him because he's still dealing with the death of Faraj. He's still dealing with, or
Daoud.
And he's dealing with the feelings that came up for him in killing Qasim. And so this is in a way a subconscious, self-destructive thing for him to do. When he gets shot, it's his penance. The penance he puts himself through.
Oh, great.
This is another thing too, him getting shots. Good. It's like, yes, I deserve this, you know. And then when he stands in front of him, he's almost saying, kill me.
Yeah.
Kill me. Put me out of my misery for what I've done, for the people I've killed, for the things I've done. I can't do it myself. You can do it.
Wow. No, that's so a great...
That's
a great
how name. I take it.
Yeah.
And so he stands up, the guy fires at him, and he just stares at him, and then Auda comes from behind and kills the guy with a sword.
The brutalness of his death with the sword is, I think, in stark contrast to what Lawrence is doing.
And, of course, then who comes around the next moment is Bentley. And he goes, Jiminy. I love that he says Jiminy.
Yeah.
I never seen a man killed by a sword before. And Lawrence's response is,
why don't you take a picture?
Wish I had.
And he's like, I would have if I'd gotten here a couple seconds sooner.
And then he wants to take a picture of Lawrence. And he goes, I don't know, just walk on the top of the train. There's some moments that are just so cinematic.
I mean,
I could describe it. He just walks on the top of the train.
Yeah.
We see it in shadow, and we see just his feet, and we see him in silhouette.
Lean just, forgive the pun, leans into it by shooting him from below, by shooting
shadow.
With the robes. And there's just something so epic and romantic despite the horrific nature of what's going around. Like, we're creating a myth. That the whole thing was that he became this mythic figure, especially because he died young and everything else. And so they're playing into that. And then by having a reporter who wants to report on a mythical hero type and is just like, just give it to me. Like, this is exactly what I want. And it's moving. It's crazy that it's moving.
And the score.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's a little later and we're with Colonel Brighton, who's on the armored car, who doesn't like the fact that people are looting. And Ollie's response, which, you know, makes sense, is, aren't British officers paid?
Truly, are not British soldiers paid?
They don't go home when they've been paid.
They are not free to.
And Arabs are leaving, and Lawrence thinks they'll come back, and he's now down to less than 200 men.
Brighton's taking him to task for this, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And rightly so.
Right. How can you trust these guys, and how many will be left, and, you know, how can you show they come back?
There's a very brief but really nice scene with Bentley and Ollie, who is studying politics from some book.
Like a children's book. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's this moment, it's like, wait, you think you're going to have a democracy? You're going to have a parliament? And Ollie's response is, I will tell you when I have a country.
Yeah.
And he's like, yep, that's just like a politician.
But in the most optimistic sense of a politician, I love that Ali's character wants to pursue politics, even though we'll see throughout the film the sort of the underbelly of that. Like, I feel like Ali understands that he will have to play the game, but he will, as a person, as a character, sort of remain a little bit above it. There's just something about his nobleness that makes you believe, like, oh, you could actually be the best version of a politician that you can be compared to some of these other people and their machinations happening in the movie.
Bentley then talks to Lawrence. He has two questions for him. The first question is,
what, in your opinion, do these people hope to gain from this war?
They hope to gain their freedom. Freedom.
They hope to gain their freedom. There's one born every minute.
They're going to get it, Mr. Bentley. I'm going to give it to them.
Again, with the cane thing. Yeah. That's the third sentence you started with I.
Oh, yeah, that's
a great point.
You
think liberty is a gift for you to give them.
Yeah.
It's just this arrogance, you know, of this character. And then he asks, what is it that draws you particularly to the desert?
It's clean.
Well, now, that's a very illuminating answer.
There's many quotes that I love from the film and I think are very indicative of the movie. But I find that one almost amusing in a way. But it's also it's wonderful to call back to when he talks much later about blood in the desert and how the desert washes the blood away, and it sort of has a halt. It calls back to this line here, and that's something that Lawrence has a hard time reconciling, but at this moment it's something he believes.
It's a weird line. I mean, it's a line where you could think about that forever and never quite know exactly what he's saying by that.
Right.
I mean, he is particular about cleanliness, that's certainly true, but I think we're in something deeper. It's a funny moment where Auda has a clock that's broken, and then he says, I need to find something honorable.
Yeah.
Cut to the train with the horses. And there's a beautiful white horse that's tied up all alone. There's an explosion. They ride in, they grab the horses, and the music cue as the horses are leaping off of this train is just stirring and amazing and, you know, fun and powerful.
Shooting that was particularly easy.
No, it's
good. Horses.
And there's a great moment when the explosion happens where the horses all react.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And looking at it, I go, what did they do there?
Yeah.
And they probably blew something up. The only thing I can think of that make all horses jump like that.
Yeah.
And now Auda's ready to go. And Brighton is pissed at Auda. It's like, Major Lawrence will campaign this winter, but you got your one and now you go home. And I think Auda's response is so profound.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When Lawrence gets what he wants, he will go home. That's a lot because I don't think Lawrence is ever going to get what he wants. And he turns to Brighton and says, and when you get what you want, you'll go home. And Brighton's like, no, I won't. I have orders.
And that's that really interesting contrast between like a British soldier, soldier mentality.
Yeah.
And don't break the rules, follow orders down to the letter. And then the Arabs who just find that frankly silly. And Lawrence who actually agrees more with the Arabs in that situation, but it is a very soldier response, and he can't wrap his head around somebody who doesn't follow orders that is supposedly fighting in an army.
Well, and it depends, you know, it's like you throw this word honor around, but it's like what defines honor for the Arabs as portrayed in this movie? They really, really care about honor. That guy drank out of my well, I gotta shoot him, you know. That's really, really serious. But it would be silly to stay when I don't want to stay anymore, or to not loot or anything like that. Whereas the British define honor as I must follow these rules, and regardless of my personal needs, to put my personal needs before these rules and what is the needs of the military as a whole, that would be dishonorable.
Yeah.
So we have a clash of honors, which ends with Brighton calling Auda a deserter. And I love Auda's response is,
give thanks to God, Brighton, that when he made you a fool, he gave you a fool's face.
Yeah. Poor Brighton.
Out of sick burns, man. Yeah. They're great. And now Lawrence is alone. It's like, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'll go north. Maybe with 20. Mm. He's just going to keep fighting that battle. And by the way, there are times in Seven Pillars where it's literally him and like two guys through the snow. There's one point where he had to transport like 20,000 pounds of gold, not pounds weight, but pounds value, but a lot of on two camels
through a snowstorm. He got caught in a snowdrift and the camel wouldn't go any further. And he's in sandals, by the way. And he would go, and the snowdrift is like 8 feet deep, and he would clear a path for 20 feet for the camel, then go back and get the camel, go forward 20 feet, clear 20 more feet, go back and get the camel, clear 20 feet, back and forth all night. Mm. You know, like the physical, we don't really get into it in this movie, but I mean, he constantly had dysentery. He had boils. He was dehydrated. He had, you know, like every single horrible thing. He just overcame it.
Yeah.
Just fighting through, because some of what he says about not being a strong man is true. This is a small guy. He was fairly frail, and he just had indomitable will. Mm. So he goes forward to continue fighting this war. We're listening on the rails because we're going to mine the tracks for a train. Mm-hmm. And guy comes up with the detonators and trips. It's really scary. And that is, again, great storytelling about, like, oh, these things are dangerous. They could blow up at any time. Farage takes one detonator and slides it in his sash, you know, at his waist, inside his shirt, against his skin. And then Lawrence comes, they're going to put the detonator in the plastique or whatever it is at that point, and he can't find the detonator. That's okay. And Lawrence's calm is great.
Yeah.
Plenty of time. Go find another one. And he's down there working at the bomb, and then you hear the explosion off camera.
Farage! Farage!
Ugh, brutal. And they run and they find Farage, who's obviously wounded, and it comes very quick that he cannot ride. We can't leave him here for the Turks.
Yep.
And it's up to Lawrence, and Lawrence wants someone else to shoot him. I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally he realizes he does have to do it, and he kneels down next to him, and Farage says,
Daoud will be angry with you.
Salute him for me.
Which is exactly what Lawrence says happened in Seven Pillars.
Oh, wow.
I think he was shot. It wasn't the detonator thing, right, but it was he had to shoot Farage in the head. Oh. And the last words were, Daoud will be angry. Salute him for me.
Damn.
This is one of those moments. There are multiple moments in his life. Qasim, Daoud, Farage. We're going to see a couple of others that Lawrence, well, that changes him forever. Mm-hmm. This is just.
As war does.
Yeah.
Right. As war does.
Yeah, this is the dark underbelly of it, the non-romantic side, side that makes you do things you don't want to do and things that you will have to live with for the rest of your life and give you nightmares. Yeah. I think these are the things that Lawrence didn't. I don't think any soldier knows until they're in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, Benchley's trying to create this romantic image of this warrior, and that warrior, part of why he is doing what he's doing because he was filled up with these romantic images. Yeah. And it's at the time that he is discovering that that's not the reality, that his image is literally being
the most romanticized,
romanticized all over the world now, because he's becoming very famous and bringing more young men in to do this thing that isn't what they're being sold.
Yeah.
It's a good thing nothing like that happens today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
And what's he going to do? He's going to continue fight.
I know. I find it, you know, very telling and also very almost heartbreaking that his reaction to losing Farage is to lean in even more on the ego and like, you know, who will walk on water with me is like basically his next, like he walks into the cave with whomever's left and basically comes up with the most daring thing he's ever come up with to go into Dara and a Turk where there's a Turk garrison, like as a white British man, he's just going to walk in there. And it's hard. Like that does seem like the culmination of all of the ego build that's been happening and happening, and I'm a prophet and I'm invincible and this guy shot at me six times and all I got was a graze in the shoulder. And but also it's a reaction to what just happened to Faraj.
Well, and this is him at his most delusional.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, he says,
who are you to know what can be done? If we'd done what you thought could be done, we'd be back in Yenbo now and nowhere. Whatever I ask them to do can be done, that's all. They know that if you don't. Do you think I'm just anybody, Ali? Do you?
And this is what's hard is, you know what? You're not just anybody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He is extraordinary.
Right.
But he's not a prophet.
You can't not read magic. Your own press. Once you read your own press, the game is over.
And he says, and as you say, it's like, we're going to go into Dara and do some reconnaissance and we're just going to walk in.
And Ali is like, you're crazy. You're why are you doing this? Like, what is your...
Really trying hard to talk him down.
Why? And he's talking to him as a friend.
Yes.
There's no longer the judgment of the old by the well.
He's worried about him.
Friend who cares about him. Yeah.
And, you know, I think we probably have all at one time or another had to have a conversation with a friend. Mm. It's rare that you actually convince them.
Yeah.
Sometimes later on they come back to you and go, hey, you remember that time that you said I shouldn't do that thing? You were right. But it's rare that we can get them at that moment. And Ali certainly can't convince him. And there's even like, do you really think you can pass for an Arab? And he says, yes, if you'll lend me some dirty clothes. Mm. Which is not a nice thing to say.
Nope.
And he goes into Dara.
Yeah.
And Jose Ferrer drives by and they're walking and Lawrence is having fun. He's sort of smiling and playing.
Dancing over puddles? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I think he's kind of round the bend.
Oh, no. Of course. He wants to get caught. He's putting himself in a position to get caught. Once again, this is my theory. And
I'm with you. To be punished.
I think he wants to be punished. He's looking to someone to punish him because he can't do it to himself.
And then the soldiers stop him or try to stop him. He just says, walk on. Mm-hmm. Just keep walking. And they grab him and they turn him around and they take him and they leave Ali and... We go into the scene with the Turkish bay.
Mm.
Jose Ferrer.
He's so creepy with a cough. Oh, he's so creepy in this whole scene.
And Peter O'Toole is a huge Jose Ferrer fan. Yeah. Cyrano de Bergerac is one of his favorite films.
It's a great film,
And didn't Jose Ferrer basically say this is one of his... He considers it one of his best, if not best, roles in terms of his own acting? That,
they had to convince him to do the movie because the part is so small. And then when he saw the movie, he said, if I am going to be judged as an actor by any performance I've ever done, those 10 minutes are the greatest work I've ever done in my entire life as an actor. And it was like, won the Oscar for doing Cyrano. Yeah. And this is
Andy has like three lines, four lines. It's like, but he is so
chilling
and disturbing. And that cough is so something.
Yeah.
It's unsettling.
And there's some other guys that have also been brought to meet the Turkish Bey, and he dismisses them and kind of studies Lawrence.
You have blue eyes. I say you have blue eyes.
Yes, Effendi.
Are you Circassian?
Yes, Effendi.
How old are you?
27, Effendi. I think.
You look older. You have had a lot of experience. It's an interesting face. I am surrounded by cattle. He wouldn't know an interesting face from a sow's belly. I have been in Dara now for 3.5 years. If they posted me to the dark side of the moon, I could not be more isolated. You haven't the least idea of what I'm talking about, have you?
No, Effendi.
Have you? No. That would be too lucky.
The scene is really weird.
It's
and
like
off-putting
Apocalypse Now, brother. It's like that end of the world place that Sheen drops off to try to find out who's running the play and giving the letters. And they're like, who the hell is, aren't you in charge, man? Like this is, they're in the, for lack of a better term, they're in the asshole of the war. This is like, this guy has been here for how long? he's drunk with his own power too.
And you get the sense that he is a well-educated person.
Yeah, but he's been stuck here forever. Stuck with,
and he makes some comments and he's like, you know, and no one understands what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, I'm surrounded by cattle.
Yeah.
You know, and he makes this speech and then looks at Lawrence and goes, oh, you have no idea what I'm talking about. And the reality is no, actually, Lawrence is the person who most understands
but what he talks about. But has to act like he doesn't.
He has to act like he doesn't. Yeah. And, you know, it's got to be interesting thinking about this scene in 1962 because it slowly takes on this sexual nature. And I don't know when you clue into like, well, what's happening here?
As soon as he grabs
his skin,
that's
going
to
rape him.
Was, yeah.
He's going
to
rape him.
He finds the bullet wound. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's like, oh, you're a deserter. And
which army?
And he goes, oh, your skin is very fair. And he leans in. And that's when it dawns on Lawrence what's about to happen.
Yeah.
And he kicks him in the balls.
Yep.
And apparently, according to T. Lawrence, he really kicked this guy in the balls.
Oh, really?
Really hard. Yeah. Wow. And they begin to beat him. They put him on this bench. And this guy pulls his arm forward. And this is great reactions from this guy.
Yeah. His leering, like, smile. Like if you weren't sure what was happening, right. That smile. And then...
And they get the cane, which they shred a little bit at the end to make it more brutal. And then they hit him. And again, we're back to the point is not minding that it hurts. Mm-hmm. Is that his reaction is to take the pain and then to not react. And then you see the guy watching him going, oh, good. Wow, you took that. And then another one, he took that. And now the guy kind of pulls a little tighter and smiles more like, oh, we're going to get to really break you because you're putting up this resistance. And of course, what do we hear in the background and see?
Coughing.
Is the coughing and Jose Ferrer watching from a distance.
Yeah.
It's a really disturbing scene. There's lots of controversy about what really happened to him. He writes about, it's funny, if you read what he writes about in Seven Pillars, it is both far more gruesome than what is here,
ooh,
but also written in a way that's so poetic that it's very hard to understand what actually happened.
Oh.
It's, you know, he describes himself being broken in this severe way. He describes the emotions of being tortured. And his desire to resist the torture, and then his realizing he cannot resist the torture, and then his desire to confess, to get anything to end the torture, but then they won't. And then the implication, he doesn't say that he was raped, but the implication is definitely that he was raped. And then there's also people have picked over this book in his life over and over again and looked at the timeline and go, well, why did he do that the next day if this happened then? Mm-hmm. And why did he write this letter to this particular person describing it this way when in the book he described it this way? And what is that all about? It's really hard to figure out exactly what in fact happened to him, but it's clear that something profound, really truly profound happened to him. This is one quote I wanted to pick out of Seven Pillars. He says, in Dara that night, the citadel of my integrity had been irrevocably lost.
That's rape.
Yeah.
That's rape.
The citadel of my integrity.
Right.
I mean, even whatever actually physically happened, emotionally, spiritually, he was raped.
Yeah.
And broken. And Ollie is waiting outside. And eventually they throw him out into the mud. Mm-hmm. There's something about the way Peter O'Toole squeezes the mud against his face. Like you could feel the coolness of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As a relief, this man who throughout this whole film is like wanted to be clean. And now he's embracing the cold mud. There's something. And now we're back up in the mountains. And again, he's gone into this state where he does not respond. And Ollie goes, sleep. Mm. He doesn't sleep. And then eat. You have a body like other men. And slowly he eats. And then he sleeps and he nods. And you see him coming back-ish.
Yeah.
Physically.
But not mentally.
Right.
Well, and to some degree, you know, he's never going to come back from this.
Right. Mm. I mean, psychologically is better than mentally. But yeah, this is... We keep talking about the fact that he thought he was invincible.
Yeah.
And this... And that he was always in control and that miraculous and then that if he said something was possible, then it was possible. And so he probably thought to himself that something like this was an impossibility to happen to him. And it did. And when you get to that point, like that, you just emotionally broken, and how do you can't ever get back to thinking that you're infallible when it's you've been given concrete proof that you are. And that's super devastating to somebody who believed in their own extraordinariness.
Yeah.
And it's like the worst thing you can, it's like worse than death, is finding out that you're not extraordinary, or that's the thing that he believes. He's any man is what I am. And that's worse than death for somebody like that.
Yeah. And he finally gets in the morning. He goes like, okay, I'm going to go back to find the jet. You go talk to Allenby. And he's learned. And he says, I've come to the end of myself.
I've come to the end of myself, I suppose.
And the end of the Arab revolt?
I'm not the Arab revolt, Ali. I'm not even an Arab.
A man can be whatever he wants. You said.
I'm sorry. I thought it was true.
You proved it.
Look, Ali. Look. That's me. What color is it? That's me. And there's nothing I can do about it.
And there's a line in here that I've thought about my whole life.
A man can do whatever he wants. You said.
He can. But he can't want what he wants.
He can't want what he wants, or I can't want what I want. I've thought about that since I saw this movie since high school. Yeah. And I think that is such a profound statement about the human condition.
Yeah.
You know, is that we make decisions about the things that we think that we want in life. And yet our behavior doesn't match up to those decisions. You know, like I go, I want to lose weight. I don't want to eat that cheeseburger. And yet I find myself eating it. And so my ability to control my desire, mm-hmm. I can't control those things within myself that make me who I am. I can't simply become another person. I can't become Orance. Mm. You know, I'm Lawrence. I am who I am. You know, like I can't, you know, that we are still trapped within some body that is built in with certain stuff. Mm. And to some degree, while we can, you know, maybe have the illusion of control, and I think to some degree we can control, actually changing ourselves is really, 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 really hard. Yep. You can't want what you want is a big one.
And heartbreaking.
And heartbreaking, yeah. And he says then he would have told him anything.
Yeah.
You know? They just didn't ask.
But the thing is, Allie's trying to tell him that anybody would. That shouldn't define you in this moment. Like, why do you hold that against yourself? Mm. And it's because Lawrence did not consider himself any man.
Right. And still doesn't, by the way.
Agreed.
I mean, like, while he's saying, oh, I guess I am just anybody, he's still saying in this way, I'm still special, you know? And so he says he's going to go back to the Jerusalem and just do a job that anyone can do. And he says, I'm going to make easy stages. He's like, you? He's like, oh, yes.
You're not going to go darting across another desert this time?
And the scene ends with him saying, can I borrow this fur? And Ali's response is,
it is not clean.
No, but it's warm.
And then finally, when he leaves, he says, trust your own people. And let me go back to mine.
It's an interesting vote of confidence in Ali, which,
yeah,
you know, in terms of, I think that one of the layers of what's happening with Lawrence right now is realizing the divide between him and the Arabs, as much as he wants to be one and be a part of their culture and see himself as one of them, that one of the reasons that he was violated was because
he's not one of them.
Yeah. And so he's seeing the divide and realizing maybe it's not crossable, but recognizing in Ali somebody who, you know, maybe could do at least to some extent what he was trying to do in the more noble sense of bringing the Arab people together. Mm. And that I like that in this moment of self-doubt, there's also a call out to Ali as being somebody that, you know, you could do this for your people.
Yeah, and I also think he's come to the end of his romantic idea of this all.
Oh,
when
that's gone at this point.
When he says that to him, he says, trust your people, let me go back to mine. Oh, now he wants to claim being part of the British people. True. When he had made fun of them from the beginning and had put himself above them and all this jazz. And now, you know, he wants to go back to his people. Why? Because that's comfort. He won't be raped there. He won't be abused there. And he just wants to get away from this whole thing and go back to some place of comfort.
I think that is exactly what he thinks.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's actually real.
Okay.
You know, because he's a person, he was never comfortable among the British.
Uh-huh.
And therefore he said, he took some ideal and said, oh, I'm supposed to be this.
Yes.
And if I can go be this, then I will feel okay. Yeah. I'll feel like one of them. And then he became that. Mm-hmm. And then he still didn't feel that way. And they had this mm-hmm. horrible experience. And in his mind, he went, oh, the lesson is I'm not that. Mm-hmm. I'm an ordinary person. I'm British. I'm just going to go back to be British. And now I'm going to go feel comfortable. But he's not.
Yeah.
And as we see right when we get there,
yeah.
there's the big marching band. He shows up in uniform and he says, you know, things in a very British mm-hmm. way, jolly good and all this stuff. And as soon as he turns the, you know, everyone says, oh, it's, you know, someone says, oh, we're putting a new squash court up. He says, oh, jolly good.
Yeah.
And he's so not behaving like himself. And as he turns the corner away from them, what do they say?
Call him out on
yeah,
it.
Yeah. They
right?
say, oh, he lays it on a bit thick.
Yeah.
He doesn't fit. He can't just become a regular British guy.
Right.
That's not in his nature.
I mean, even it's even driven home to the point of like his uniform doesn't fit him
yeah.
because it's not he lost his along the way yeah. or whatever he yeah. says. And whatever one he got to borrow is so clearly ill fitting mm-hmm. to him. And it's just hitting you like
you
don't fit in anywhere.
No. Yeah.
And he sees Bentley, he says, oh, it's good to be back. And no one believes him. Like, right. that's, no, it doesn't. Come on. And he goes to meet Allenby. And
guess who's there?
Faisal's there. And he's not, that is not good to see him.
Nope.
And there's this moment where Faisal says, oh, Orange. Oh, I'm sorry. Is it Major Lawrence now? And he salutes him. That's rough.
Yep.
And now we hear for the first time about this treaty.
Sykes-Picot
treaty, which is real yeah. thing. And Allenby and Dryden are lying about it. And Faisal's calling them on their lies. And Lawrence goes, treaty? And Faisal goes, oh, he does it much better than you do. Because
so
this
good.
Is the first time that he's hearing about it. And this is not true. In fact, Lawrence knew about the Sykes-Picot for a long time. And he is the one who told Faisal in complete disobedience of the British orders. This was really a traitorous act on his part to inform the Arabs of the Sykes-Picot Treaty. And what the Sykes-Picot Treaty is, for those of you who don't know, is that it was a deal between two fairly minor bureaucrats who really, like Sykes had never even been in the area. He knew nothing about, I mean, the guy was like an arrogant mm-hmm. person with no experience, who no like knowledge of the area, who just decides that he's capable of making a peace treaty. I don't know if anyone would be doing a thing like that now. And makes a deal with Picot, who's a French, and they just said, after this war, the British and the French are going to split up all of this area, all the Ottoman Empire, and this is how we're going to do it.
Mm.
Again, can't imagine any Europeans making decisions like that today mm-hmm. or Americans, but yeah, you know, there you go. But yeah, Lawrence told him, and it's created one of those splits of guilt within him of whose side is he on by revealing this to Faisal early.
Yeah.
Faisal leaves, and there's a great moment with Dryden where he says,
and let's have no displays of indignation. You may not have known, but you certainly had suspicions. If we've told lies, you've told half lies. And a man who tells lies, like me, merely hides the truth. But a man who tells half lies has forgotten where he put it.
Some lines where I go like, I don't exactly know what that means, but that is a great line.
It's when you sort of have to dissect for a few minutes and like, okay, I think.
And Lawrence says, I want an ordinary job. And Allenby's like, what?
You're a serving officer in the field, and as it happens, a damned important one. Personal, are you mad?
No. And if you don't mind, I'd rather not go mad. That's my reason, too.
It's very honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think, like, in terms of especially what happens over the course of this scene and how he's manipulated rather easily back into things. But the fact that he understands that psychologically
he's
in a
edge.
Very yeah. precarious place right now, but that is something that they don't care about, or that it is not a priority to them. This last push to Damascus is the priority.
Allenby wants him to be part of the big push.
I don't want to be part of your big push.
What about your Arab friends? What about them?
I have no Arab friends. I don't want Arab friends.
Peter O'Toole, man.
Yeah.
The ability to play so goofy and cute and soft and smart and intelligent and manipulative, and then to have this level of power
yeah.
that's happening in this scene. And that's when Dryden notices that there's blood on his back.
Yeah.
And I love that he says something to Lawrence so he turns so Allenby can see it. That's like a brilliant little moment. Mm-hmm. And Dryden leaves. And, you know, Allenby kind of is talking to Lawrence and says, oh, there's blood on your back. Do you want a doctor? And Lawrence is like, no. It's a great moment. Mm-hmm. Bentley's waiting outside. There's a great moment with Dryden talking to Bentley. Bentley's trying to find out what's going on inside.
Oh, so great.
It's such the again, the Americanness of it, but also the reporter like looking for his scoop. What's going on in there?
So what goes on in there?
Nothing.
Oh, come on.
No, really. Nothing at all.
Is the man in trouble?
I expect so. We all have troubles. Life's a veil of troubles.
Just let me know if the man's in trouble. I've got an interest in that man. I've got a claim.
What claim?
You've read my stuff. I've made that boy a hero. When the war's over, that boy can be anything he wants.
Yes. Well, at the moment, he wants to be somebody else.
And then...
Well, I'll tell you. It's a little clash of temperament that's going on in there. Inevitably, one of them's half mad, and the other wholly unscrupulous.
The great line.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way he plays Dryden that I really love. And it's very similar to how he played Prince John in Robin Hood.
Mm.
He injects this sort of playful, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, femininity to him. And I mean that in no negative way. I mean that there is a dance that he is doing that he enjoys. He's almost, well, I don't know if feminine is right.
He's effete.
He's enjoying himself.
Yeah.
He's enjoying himself in these moments of the back and forth. And you can see the smirk on his face the whole time as he's having the back and forth with Bentley, which is great. And when he has the back and forth, when he knows better in the room about stuff, it's enjoyable. And when he plays these roles, Reigns is just unstoppable. He has the same thing in Casablanca. He has those moments where he just knows better than whoever's in the room with him, and it's great.
He has an elegant and whimsical detachment.
There we go.
Nice.
There we go.
Now Allenby's going to really use his powers.
Hmm.
I mean, this is, you know, you take a guy, he's looking at a guy who's completely on edge, completely fallen apart. I think Allenby reads him correctly, and I really think he needs this guy to be back in the field. And so he's going to manipulate him into doing it.
By speaking to his ego.
Yep. Yeah.
I believe your name will be a household word when you would have to go to the War Museum to find who Allenby was. You're the most extraordinary man I ever met. Leave me alone.
And I think this was dubbed. I think this is older Peter O'Toole dubbing this part because they had lost the sound. And there's this moment where he finally says, all right, I'm extraordinary. As an admission.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That he's been given permission to make in a way too. Like if these people are saying it, then I can say it out loud and believe it again. Not that he probably, like you said, ever really truly disbelieved it, but he had a major blow to his sense of invincibleness.
Yeah.
But it was sort of rather easy for them to coax him back into, because he wants to be a great man. He wants to be that figure. He sees himself as you can picture him thinking, what are kids going to read in their history books 50 years from now about me? And I want to play into that. I want to be that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, like there's a distinction that I don't think Lawrence gets that's important, which is that extraordinary means beyond ordinary, which he clearly is. He is smarter and more driven and more articulate, and he is beyond the ordinary. That's true. It doesn't make you a god.
Right? And that's a bit of a leap.
And the thing that he keeps thinking is that he's a god.
Right.
It's like, no, you're just smarter and better and more talented than everybody else. Therefore, you can do stuff that other people can't do. It doesn't mean you're invulnerable, you know? And he keeps confusing the two. And there's a great little thing where Allenby uses this weird logic game of like, you know, you have a destiny and you shouldn't throw that away. And Lawrence's response is, oh, do you know that from personal experience? Well, no. Ah, then you're guessing. And what's funny is there's this moment where Lawrence then just abandons the argument.
You're guessing then. Suppose you're wrong.
Why suppose that? We both know I'm right.
Yes.
After all,
I said yes.
I get the game you're playing. You won. I'm going back.
I'm going to go back. And we go back into the plan. And what we hear is that we're pushing towards Damascus. Mm-hmm. And Lawrence says, we're going to get there before you.
They won't be coming for money, not the best of them. They'll be coming for Damascus, which I'm going to give them.
So he'll play their game.
Yeah.
But with his own motivation
right.
yeah. in play.
Which Allenby's okay with.
Yep.
That's all I want.
All you want is someone holding down the Turkish right. But I'm going to give them Damascus. We'll get there before you do. And when we've got it, we'll keep it. You can tell the politicians to burn their bit of paper now.
Fair enough.
Fair. What's fair got to do with it? It's going to happen. I shall want quite a lot of money.
All there is.
Not that much. The best of them won't come for money. They'll come for me.
There it is. He's back.
Well...
Some version of
a version of
in
him,
a,
yeah.
in a very much darker version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's funny. We hear the cheers as he's saying that.
Mm-hmm. This movie was, as an editor, I'm sure you know this, is one of the original movies that did the L cut. You can when you hear the next scene, the sound from the next scene, while you're still on the shot from the previous scene, mm-hmm. it's done. All the time now,
right.
But this was one of the early films that made that a very particular choice. I saw an interview with Anne B. Coates, and she talked about that.
It's crazy to me, by the way, that she is still editing today.
I know, yeah. She's amazing.
I looked at her IMDb. She cut 50 Shades of Grey.
Huh. Yep.
She's cut. I'll tell you some of her lists. She's cut all sorts of stuff. Murder on the Orient Express.
The original,
74.
Yeah.
Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan.
Yeah!
Elephant Man. She cut Raw Deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger. She cut What About Bob? Chaplin, In the Line of Fire, Out of Sight, Aaron Brockovich.
Wow.
50 Shades of Grey, and is still working.
That's amazing.
And Lawrence of Arabia. And she's born in like 1929.
Wow.
And she is still cutting.
Damn right.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Totally amazing. So,
hero of mine.
And we're back in the desert with Lawrence riding at the head of his army and Ollie and Benchley talking about whether or not Lawrence has changed.
What did that Turkish general do to him in Daraa?
He was the same man after Daraa. The same man. Humbled.
I thought that was a brilliant exchange because when he says what happened to him in Daraa, Ollie says he came back the same man. Pause, humbled,
yeah.
mm. which is a really interesting word to use. And then he flips it and he goes,
what did the English general do to him in Jerusalem?
Search me.
What happened to him in Jerusalem? Right. What do those yeah. generals do to him? And it's right. like, he was abused by both.
Yeah.
In very different ways and very interesting ways. And again, it's just this pitting of the British way of doing things and the Arab or Turk ways of doing things and all encapsulated in just a couple of lines between these two characters.
Well, and that, you know, this is definitely goes to you can't want what you want is that mm. the person who doesn't seem to be in control of what's happening to him is Lawrence.
Yeah.
You know, we have a quick staff meeting with the general. We're talking about pounding them with artillery. We see the bombing in the distance. And Ollie's response to this tremendous artillery barrage is, God help them. To which Lawrence says, well, they're Turks. And Ollie still, God help them. Mm. And you take
he's
this,
the one who understands humanity. Lawrence is losing sight of it fast.
Totally lost it. Mm-hmm. And this is someone who started off being fairly compassionate.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, worried about how many people he killed. That's not the Lawrence that we see now.
No.
The British army continues to march. Brighton catches up with Allenby, who's in a rolls, and just like he's got the biff between his teeth, which means he's moving too fast. And then they mention that there's this Turkish column. And I think the implication is that they kind of put it in their path to slow Lawrence down. Is that right. Is that the impression that you get?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want him getting to Damascus fast
enough.
Oh, no,
the British absolutely didn't. That's why they kept checking, where is he? Where is Lawrence? Nobody actually knows. And it turns out that he's moving faster than they thought. And so, yeah, absolutely. That's a move on their part.
So this experience with the Turkish column is another one of those events, a real event from Lawrence's life that is one of those events that broke him, along with some others. And this happened right near Daraa. That's part of why they think that he did this, is that they were very, very close to it.
He's still very dealing with what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, and they had just literally just ridden by it. They had passed a village that this Turkish column had wiped out, which we see a little bit of in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that essentially commits suicide by attacking all on his own. That
was his village, right?
That was his village.
Yep.
And that really did happen.
It did.
That really did happen in front of Lawrence.
Wow.
we're in this argument of Ollie going, no, we got to go to Damascus. We can't, there's no reason to attack these people. And there really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And what's going on in Peter O'Toole's face, soul, eyes is just really crazy.
Yep.
Orance, not this. Go round. Damascus, Orance. Damascus.
No prisoners.
And finally, Lawrence yells out, no prisoners.
No prisoners! No prisoners!
And they charge down the hill. No prisoners is a concept that we don't even really have anymore.
No.
You know, that it's just, of course you could never do such a thing. Mm-hmm. And yet.
But it's a phrase we still use.
Sure.
Take no prisoners.
Especially with sports.
Yeah.
Take no prisoners.
But we don't really mean it in war. And we see what it means in this scene.
Yeah.
Because they just wipe these people out. You see Ollie's reaction. You know, he didn't want to attack and they're charging. And then his sort of, you know, just says, oh God. And then gets swept up in the attack.
Yeah.
Because what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, the moment in the battle with the Turkish column, if you can call it the slaughter, I guess.
Yeah.
That's so powerful to me is that there's a Turkish soldier who surrenders to him.
Yes.
Mm. Raises his hands in surrender. And Lawrence, without hesitation, shoots him in the head.
Yep.
And then he continues firing until his gun is out of ammo. Mm-hmm. And then that's when Ollie sees him. And then Ollie's trying to get him to stop. And there's just this look on his face as he sees Ollie of shame and fear and lack of control. And he runs away.
Yep.
I think that is so important.
Well, he's seeing the it's cheesy, but like the himself reflected in this person who's showing how horrifying what he's doing. And he can't face that.
Yeah.
And so he has to run away from that reaction, run away from himself.
And I'm reminded in this moment of there was something about it I didn't like. I enjoyed it.
Mm.
And that part of Lawrence's soul that enjoyed the killing, that's taken over now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And inspired by the darkness that he's gone through ever since that initial killing Qasim, it's a culmination of all of the, you know, the negative side effects or things that have happened because of him, all the deaths that have happened, his violation, the way he's been used and abused by people all around him, and this sense of you know, no longer being invincible or infallible, and so just give in.
Yeah.
And he gives in to that darker sense and does it in a way that is brutal. I mean, that final shot of him covered in blood, he's exhausted from all the killing he's done, holding the knife and you just
staring at it very much how he did when he looked at his own reflection in the knife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite shots in the movie, because he has descended into the depths of himself, and he is now having this internal battle externally, and the cover and the staring of the knife, he is once again in one of his trances where he is just he probably doesn't even sense that there is a battle going on or deaths are being, like, he is so caught up in questioning where he's at in himself, and the fact he's all covered up, and it's just a very powerful image, you know.
So, and as Lawrence is sitting covered in blood, who comes up walking through the remains of this battle but Bentley?
Jesus wept.
Does it surprise you, Mr. Bentley? Surely you know the Arabs are a barbarous people, barbarous and cruel. Who but they? Who but they?
Oh, you rotten man. Here, let me take your rotten, bloody picture. For the rotten, bloody newspapers.
This is the first place I heard the expression, Jesus wept.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That is a profound phrase, to a non-religious person. Jesus wept. Mm-hmm. And then he sees bloody Lawrence and says, let me take your bloody picture for the bloody newspaper.
Oh, you great man. Yeah. Let me take your bloody picture.
It's great. And again, we're writing, and there's that isolated out. Disconnected Lawrence, and someone runs up and they have grapes from Damascus. We're almost there. But the grapes aren't ripe yet. I'm going to say that's a little symbolic.
A bit.
And we've arrived at Damascus, and we actually got here a day and a half before the British. The British are entering, and Lawrence has set up a headquarters in the town hall, and we're having a conversation between Allenby and his staff about, well, do we push them out of Damascus? Faisal's coming on his way. And Allenby's saying, no, everyone stand down, go to the barracks, don't do anything. And someone says, we can't just do nothing. And I love Allenby's line.
Look, sir, we can't just do nothing.
Why not? It's usually best.
I've heard this. I think this comes from an AA phrase, which is to reverse the expression, don't just stand there, do something. And the expression is, don't just do something, stand there. And sometimes that's the best advice. Yeah. No, don't do anything.
Yeah.
Just stand there. And that's what Allenby chooses to do. And he says, in particular, all technical units and particularly the medical should do nothing.
Yeah.
It clearly shows that he has a strong understanding of the situation, in that neither Lawrence nor this very unstable coalition of Arab tribes have any idea what it actually takes to not just conquer Damascus, but then actually to run it.
Yeah. Well, and this is, Allenby is a brilliant bastard. Mm-hmm. Wholly unscrupulous, as Dryden describes him.
Yep.
And he's right. We're in a council meeting and everyone is yelling. There's complete chaos. Alda and Ollie are arguing. Finally, Lawrence uses a gun as a gavel to call them to order. And he's trying to pull them together, but they keep arguing. The telephone needs the electricity. And Alda is attacking Ollie because Ollie's supposed to provide the electricity. And Lawrence forces Ollie to apologize, which I think 2 years earlier he would never have done.
Right.
They would have had a blood feud. The reality is they need English engineers. Mm-hmm. But if you bring in English engineers, then you bring in the British government. And we hear there's a fire, but no water pressure. And Lawrence goes to leave, and everyone is coming at him from every direction with petitions. And the chaos of this moment is just, with everything he did to get here, it's just tragic, because I think you see this, what's going to happen,
Oh yeah. The writing was on the wall. Clearly the British, Allenby knew it. And we probably, I think most viewers probably realize that that you're going to win Damascus for the Arabs, but it's always much easier to conquer a place than it is to actually rule it.
Yeah.
And he's learning the hard way.
Well, and the British Empire have had a few hundred years of conquering places and establishing.
True.
And this goes back to the Brighton philosophy of the military and honor, is like, those troops are going to go in and they're going to do their jobs and they know how to do things and they're well organized and they're very disciplined and they will get stuff done.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. And back in, of course, in the British headquarters, what's Allenby doing as fires are burning and all this chaos is happening? He's practicing his fishing, his casting.
Yep.
Maybe I should take this up after the war. Mm. And the power goes out, and we see that Arabs are leaving the city.
Yep.
Allenby's winning.
He'd waited it out.
Yeah.
He understood that was inevitable.
Yep.
Now we're back at this big council chamber, and pretty much Lawrence is alone. He's still trying to write out paperwork, and this guy hasn't slept.
Yeah.
He's just working himself solidly. And Alda says, let's just leave here. Go back to the desert. And Alda says, I know your heart. Mm-hmm. Do you think he knows Lawrence's heart?
I think as much as anybody could know Lawrence's heart, I think Alda would. Why not? Because he's an unknowable person.
I think he's unknowable.
Right.
I think he knows the one section of his heart very well. But I don't...
Yeah, I think he recognizes Lawrence as a fellow warrior, as a fellow leader, as...
A man with bloodlust.
Revenges. And who understands honor amongst, who understands the Arab version of honor, who even though he's a British person, and recognizes that at least at one time, probably not now, but the Lawrence that he first knew and fought with was a lover of the desert. Mm-hmm. And that is where Alda is going. And he wants to appeal to that version of Lawrence and sees that part of it. But it doesn't understand that is not the whole of Lawrence.
Yeah. The insecure, introverted, self-critical, deeply conflicted person. I don't think Alda can understand that person.
No.
I don't think that's... And Lawrence takes the paper back and goes back to writing, and Alda asks him, is it the blood?
Is it the blood? The desert has dried up more blood than you could think of.
And that's in theory, one of the beauties of the desert. That's why the desert is clean. And I find that harkening back to what Lawrence used to think as the reason why he loved the desert. And I thought it was very telling that Outa calls back to it in a way, but Lawrence has now seen the blood and seen the blood that the desert has taken from his friends, from his own person, and can't see the desert as clean anymore.
And his response is, I pray that I never will see the desert again. Mm. Hear me, God. Mm. And what Outa says back to him is so... I hope no one ever says anything like this to me.
Mm. You will come. There is only the desert for you.
Like, I don't want someone to make a prophetic statement about my life like that. That is scary.
There is only the cinephiles for you.
Mm. That's cool. I like the show.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Yes.
It's fine. I have no relation to the cinephiles like T. Lawrence has to the desert. There's been no Dara.
Fair point.
Sure, Apocalypse Now was a difficult episode, but it wasn't. I didn't feel that the sanctity of my integrity had been forever irrevocably changed or whatever. Okay. I should have said Armageddon.
You haven't been raped by the cinephiles yet.
Not yet.
We do Lord of the Rings.
No! Don't tell Rachel I said that!
What?
Don't tell Rachel I said that!
Is that your movie?
Let's just say I've grown up on Tolkien. It's my favorite book. It is in the top 10 movies. I have multiple Lord of the Rings tattoos, and I am a contender in the inner geekdom, almost solely based on my extraordinary knowledge of Lord of the Rings.
Nerd.
And he doesn't like hobbits, so this is a point of contention.
I certainly don't like hobbits. They unsettle me.
It's the hairy feet.
Yes! The high-pitched squeals. Yes, go ahead.
And then... Lawrence is with Ollie and says, and looks at him like, are you going to leave too? And he says he's going to stay and learn politics. Something he had no thought of when he met Lawrence. And Ollie still is trying to give him some kindness. You tried very hard to give us Damascus.
Yeah.
And he says, well, that's what I came for. And where Ollie sees it as, what you did is amazing, and you should know the amazingness of what you did.
Yeah. All Lawrence can see is failure.
That's exactly right. Mm. Yeah. And then we have Outa and Ollie.
This is a beautifully heartbreaking scene.
It's a great scene. Yeah. And the argument they have, you're right, it's heartbreaking.
They're fighting for his soul.
Yeah.
He is your friend.
Your hand away.
You love him.
No, I fear him.
And why do you weep?
If I fear him, would love him. How must he fear himself who hates himself? Oh. Yes.
I cry. Because Conan cannot cry. I cry for Conan. Exactly. That's what that moment is, man.
It's true.
Yeah.
That might be the first ever Conan Lawrence of Arabia comparison that I know of. But I think you're right on the money.
I cry because he will not cry.
And it's funny, their relationship is kind of fascinating.
It's the movie.
Explain.
It's the two sides of the coin.
Mm.
It is Ali is the intelligent, somewhat brought up in the higher echelon of the Arab world. And of course, I don't know, so anybody, please don't get offended. I'm saying this from the movie. He conveys that the cerebral approach, the more higher above it approach. Whereas Ali is the ground troops. I mean, Outa is the ground troops. Ali is the sky. Outa is the ground. You cannot win without one. You have to. You have both in effective use and equal use to win. So you need someone who is willing to do the dirty work down on the trenches, and you need someone who's above that you can call in the strikes from. And that's what those guys are. That's what they represent. And so that's why, to me, if you don't have two sides of that same coin bouncing off Lawrence the whole time, it doesn't work. The film doesn't work.
Well, and I think on some level, there are two sides of Lawrence's personality.
Sure.
Absolutely.
He might have some other sides too, but like Outa representing the warrior of him, the killer, the man of action, and Ali being the more cerebral, more thoughtful,
the noble
politician, the noble, younger.
Right. Yep. Which is why he has a better relationship with Ali, because Ali is who he thinks he is and Outa is who he can be, and he doesn't want to have as close of a relationship with Outa as he has with Ali.
But Ali's the one who is the more understanding of the two and the more forgiving of the two. And the one who sees the good despite the bad, which is something that it's not even a consideration for Outa one way or the other. And for Lawrence, it's just not a point of view he can see himself from, even though Ali is showing him the best version of himself.
And they have a last moment where Outa tells Ali, being an Arab will be thornier than you imagine. Mm-hmm. And Ali disappears in the shadows, and that's all we see of him.
Yeah.
And being an Arab will be thornier than you imagine is certainly prophetic.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. It's the next morning. A medical officer comes to Allenby and he says, insists that he must take over. And Allenby's like, no, I'm giving you orders. And there's this conflict of like, you know, at what point can the doctor say, no, I'm not listening to your orders. Right. And someone visits Lawrence and they tell him about the Turkish military hospital, and his response is, and then it's a disaster. And he goes,
what's it like?
That's a weird line. Yeah. Because that line isn't, what can I do to help?
Yeah.
It's his curiosity to look into the worst of humanity. And the descriptions about the Turkish hospital and Seven Pillars, again, it's the same thing as whatever happened in Dara. It is brutal and disgusting and nonspecific. I mean, kind of, you know, it's like, take a really good poetical writer and have them write about the most vile thing you can imagine.
Yeah.
And his experience of going there. I mean, it is really rough. Mm. He goes to this hospital, and I really think this is is the biggest life-changing experience in his life was this hospital. And I think he spent several days there, wow, by the way, trying to clean it up.
Makes sense.
And yes, a British doctor did show up, mm-hmm, and did slap him, thinking he's an Arab.
Yes.
Outrageous! You filthy little wolf!
Ironic. The one person,
yeah,
who thinks
he's, yeah, the
Arab.
One guy.
Yeah, yeah, the one guy.
You I can fool. Lawrence laughs. Lawrence's laugh is just
maniacal. Oh, it's incredible. It's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's crazy.
I love that laugh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now Faisal's in a meeting with Allenby. Well, and what's weird about the scene is we're not even that aware that Lawrence is there,
yeah,
for a while. And then we see him standing in the shadows in British uniform. He's told he's promoted colonel, has almost no effect on him. I mean, this guy's completely shattered.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And at this point, that's fine for them. It's better for them that, yes, he is.
Yeah.
He's less of a
served head. His purpose.
Mm-hmm. Faisal has a great line that's,
young men make wars, and the virtues of war are the virtues of young men. Courage and hope for the future. Then old men make the peace. And the vices of peace are the vices of old men. Mistrust and caution. It must be so.
Yeah.
Unreal.
That,
so
to me,
good.
Is the line of the movie. Yeah. Now, honestly, from top to bottom, that is the line. Whenever Alec Guinness says that, I get a stupid grin on my face because it is the line of the movie. It describes the entire movie.
Yep. And it's really problematic,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. Like, you wish you could combine the hope of the young men with the caution of the old men.
It's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
Only Justin Trudeau has been able to do it in Canada. Only him.
He's a very handsome man.
He is a handsome man.
And Lawrence starts to exit, and Faisal says to him, what I owe you is beyond evaluation.
Mm.
But Lawrence is already gone.
Yeah.
He's not even staying to talk to him.
And it's also... it's a compliment, but it's like, especially like afterwards,
yeah,
when you hear him talk, like it's almost horrifying,
yep,
because like, yeah, he does owe him a lot, but in this really kind of almost dirty, political, underhanded,
mm-hmm,
I have used and abused and it makes my skin crawl a little bit, to be honest.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because he doesn't factor in what he took out of for that.
You get the feeling that he's callous enough to, mm-hmm, just be like, the cost here, not just in the deaths that have happened in mm-hmm, those that were close to Lawrence, but the crushing of your soul,
right,
is casualty of war.
And
it wasn't Ali who said this, but since Ali is part of Faisal's, you can make the connection. He doesn't matter. The well is all that matters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't matter.
Wow, that's great.
Arab, the what they're doing is what matters.
Well, and to some degree, there's truth here,
yeah,
in terms of the way that we look at war.
I mean,
you know, sacrificing a pawn to win the war,
mm-hmm,
that is the nature of what we're doing here.
Happens all the time.
Yeah. And the Lawrence heads out, and this is the moment we talked about where someone shakes his hand just to say he's done it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Lawrence says, haven't we met before?
Yes. And that's the guy who slapped him.
And then we come back in with Allenby and Faisal. This is some cold stuff.
Yeah, man.
This is where you really see it. And it's funny, too, because Allenby realizes it at the, yeah, end, too. And you, we've been on the military side of things, and we've been on the ground and the fighting and all of that. And then this is where the real history is made. It's the real actual horrible stuff that's going on is all done via politics and via this like this crazy back and forth, and it's so eye opening. And you'd gotten hints that Faisal was smarter than you in all of his interactions with various people, but this scene was proof that he had, in a lot of ways, manipulated everything up until this point, or at least saw Lawrence and realized he could use him as a pawn in, you know, to put him in the best negotiating position he could be, considering the Sykes-Picot Treaty and how it was all going to go down.
Yeah.
And we get this idea that of how powerful the image of Lawrence has been.
And that it can be used to Faisal's advantage.
And Faisal says,
but then Orange is a sword with two edges. We are equally glad to be rid of him, are we not?
And there it is. There's the true colors of what Lawrence really actually meant to him.
Yep. Yeah. And Allenby's like shocked by that. The first time. Yeah. The cynical, you know,
the guy
totally
who
unscrupulous.
Also used Lawrence. Yeah. Yeah. Like, oh, you did too.
I thought I was a hard man, sir. You are merely a general. I must be a king.
That is a great thing to come out. And what's interesting is how much we faded away from Lawrence.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like we're not. He's not really going to exist from the Turkish hospital on. Mm-hmm. We'll see him, but he's a shadow, you know? And
the world got the better of him.
Yeah. Mm. And they're kind of finishing their deal, the two of them, and Brighton just can't even be in the room anymore. Nope. He's so upset.
Right. Of all people.
Yeah.
Even if you, when you turn Brighton off, you know you've gone too far.
Well, he's come to admire Lawrence as a great man and sees, and as you said, he's the most honorable man in the movie, you know? And so this is just not right.
And for him to have that final, like he tries to catch Lawrence, tries to, to run out and see him off in the distance. And like, you wonder what he would have said if he had caught him to like, to maybe, because he can't have been unaware of the shell of a man that Lawrence was standing in that room in the background in the shadow, as you said, and then, you know, to basically just be promoted in order to ship him back to England. He gets to the stairs and he can't get to Lawrence, and just the look on his face, and you're just like, you get it. You get what just happened over the course of these 2 years and how it affected this man, and then also history and everything else. Like, it's encapsulated by this minor character who went through this arc that I just...
And he's off in this Jeep, which, by the way, they weren't wearing pants, just so you know. They're honking at the Arabs, and you watch Lawrence sort of look at the Arabs.
Yeah.
And the camels,
From almost like he's from a distance, like, oh, I can't be part of that anymore. It's not happening anymore. And the guys try to be nice and going home.
Going home.
Trying to talk to him. And I love that the glass on the Jeep is dirty. So we can't even really see his face well.
Well, sir. Going home. Home, sir.
And as they drive off, we hear the theme again. I think this might be the smallest ending of the biggest movie. You know, like we've had such scope and it really ends almost with a whimper,
but with a little allusion to the beginning because
with
the
motorcycle.
Well,
absolutely.
Because we had started at the end with this film. It's interesting. Then where do you end? Then you end just prior to that in, this is the end of that version of T.E. Lawrence.
Right. Because it's called Lawrence of Arabia, not T.E. Lawrence.
No.
Lawrence of or something that time.
Yeah. He continues to be a fascinating person. I mean, his relationship with Faisal, by the way, didn't end here. Faisal asked him to go with him to Paris for the peace treaty. And he was there meeting with President Wilson and David Lloyd George, who is the Prime Minister of England, and Georges Clemenceau from France, to, and these are the guys that divided up the way the world looks today. Mm. Like all of the borders, not just European borders, but African borders, Middle Eastern borders. So all these countries like Lebanon and Jordan and Syria and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Dubai and all those, they were created by this meeting in Paris in 1919. And Lawrence and Faisal did not get what they want. And they basically made all sorts of deals to put various people in charge that they, and this is also right at the same moment that oil was being discovered in the Middle East. And so, because at the time of Lawrence of Arabia, they didn't really know that. And then by the 1919 and then 1920, 1922, they started to know that. And so the American, British, and French needs start to pressure that. And, you know, Ibn Saud and the Wahhabists, who were radical Muslims in the Arab group, well, that's Saudi Arabia. That's where Saudi Arabia comes from.
Wow.
Faisal becomes the king of what becomes Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Hussein becomes the king of Jordan. You know, France is in charge of Lebanon. And, you know, like the relationship between these countries as divided up by Sykes-Picot, this manipulation, and it's such a failure and so depressing to Lawrence, who had been really in charge of a lot of this. He went into this unbelievably deep depression and he returns home. And as a child, he had been fascinated by the story of knights and great warriors and lords and always wanted to be that. And they say, oh, you have a meeting at Buckingham Palace. And he goes to Buckingham Palace and they bring him into a room. And there's the king sitting in front of him. And next to the king is a sword. And in front of the king is a something to kneel on. And he goes, oh, they're going to knight me. I'm going to be Sir T.E. Lawrence. And he turns around and he walks out. So one of the only people in history to refuse being knighted by the king.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Wow.
Speaks to, I mean, like what you, the quotes you were reading earlier, he had no confidence in himself.
Yeah.
That to actually, like, as much as he wanted to be in the limelight and he wanted to be a great man figure, he actually deep down did not believe he deserved that.
Well, and I think he came to the end of the romantic view of what he saw, that what started in Aqaba ended in Dara and with the Turkish column and the Turkish military hospital. You know, he discovered that this was fraud and this was violence and death and murder and blood, and he shouldn't be knighted.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I think, I mean, I don't want to say what he thought. Like, I should back up a little bit, but clearly he was deeply depressed and conflicted by his actions in the war and how little it meant. I mean, that's what's so tragic about the story, is the vision he had of a united Arab, peaceful, democratic government moving forward. Well, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, after this all fell apart, he changed his name. The first name was John Ross, and he rejoined the Air Force. He joined the Air Force as a private. And did that for several years. And at one point, Faisal comes to London and says, I need to meet my old friend Lawrence. And he's like, I don't want to meet him. And this is really, you know, we didn't have these terms like PTSD or clinical depression. Yeah. But that's really where he was. And he's like, I don't want to meet him. And Winston Churchill and some of the, because his friends, by the way, were like Winston Churchill and George Bernard Shaw and all these people while he was living in some obscure army base as a private. And they go, no, we got to bring you. And they bring him to London and they put him in a colonel uniform. And they make him eat a meal with Faisal, and he didn't speak basically the whole meal. He just couldn't talk to him. And then if everyone finds out that, oh, this John Ross is really T.E. Lawrence, because he's this hugely famous person.
Yep.
He changes his name again to T.E. Shaw, because one of his good friends is George Bernard Shaw, and he joins the army as a private again and spends the next 10 years in the army.
Wow.
And he was like a supply sergeant. You know, he worked his way up to that, and he worked on motorcycles in his spare time and rode motorcycles. It's a very sad story for him. It is not a very sad story for the movie Lawrence of Arabia, which was released in 1962. The first version was what we have now is the director cut, 3 hours and 42. Then they cut 20 minutes out. Then they cut 10 minutes out. It was had different lengths at different places. The movie was so popular that it went to a place where certain theaters had you mail in advance to reserve tickets months away.
Wow.
That's part of this is with a movie that long, you can only do 2 showings a day.
Yeah.
It took a long time for everybody to see this movie.
Yeah.
And everybody certainly did. It won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Cinematographer, Screenplay, Music, Editing, and Design.
But not acting.
He lost to Gregory Peck for To Kill a Mockingbird.
Fuck that.
I mean, look, you that is a very tough call.
I don't think it is. I really do. I love Gregory Peck.
Don't get me wrong.
I love the movie. I love Gregory Peck in it. Mm-hmm. But if you compare those two performances, I don't think there's a comparison. You know,
the movie is beautiful. Peck's performance is solid and good.
It's great.
I mean,
but
he's
what
like
Lawrence does is a whole.
I mean, if I had to pick personally,
yeah.
I am affected by Lawrence of Arabia. It's clearly where I've been talking about it for hours at this point with you guys. So I would give it to Peter O'Toole, but this is not a question. This is not one of those Oscars somebody won that
not,
somebody
no.
lost
oh,
where
right,
I'm
right,
like,
right, right, right. Gregory Peck's great.
Yeah.
It's not totally. a crime.
Right? Yeah.
Look, if Gregory Peck had played Atticus Finch on the back of a camel in 130 degree weather over 2 years in the desert, then maybe I give it
at all.
But no respect, no disrespect to Mr. Gregory Peck. He went to my alma mater. He went to UC Berkeley. So,
oh, wow.
So we had to like him.
Yes.
And then in the 80s, it was restored. And this is, you know, for me, this is one of those movies that it's in the theater. I'm going to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
John, can you please tell me your final thoughts on Lawrence of Arabia?
Well, I've got another 4 hours of final thoughts. No. Will there
be an intermission?
There'll be an intermission.
An overture.
Listen, here's what I can tell you about the movie. No matter how many times you watch it, you haven't watched it enough. And you can't say that about a lot of great films, even the most incredible films that are lauded by numerous awards or organizations or critic circles or whatever. And like the great ones, and I've said this and I don't want to repeat myself, but I've said this before, like when you see it, it's one of those films you can see over and over again and get something new out of it at each time, something new to explore for yourself, something new to explore in the actual movie. And it'll teach you about film. That's the number one thing I tell you about Lawrence of Arabia. It'll teach you about film. As we talked about these last two parts, you will appreciate cinematography, appreciate editing, appreciate acting, direction, camera angles. It's all here to teach you what cinema can be. But at the heart of it is this very complicated man going through his own personal journeys. And there's something here for you to explore as you watch Lawrence explore his journeys as well, from the idealism of a young man to what we all experience in life, which is things don't always work out the way we want them to. People lie, people betray, we get hurt, and how we react to that hurt is what matures us. And these are the journeys that he goes through the whole movie. By the end, we hope we don't walk away from life and escape, as Steve was pointing out. He escaped in the Air Force, escaped into the Army. We hope we come out like Faisal or like Dryden or like Allenby with a more circumspect view on the world. But as you watch this movie, it will take you places that you've never gone to in any other movie. And it will make you fall in love with it over and over and over again. And that's the only way I can speak about the film from my point of view.
How about you? What do you think?
I've said this before, even earlier, but I feel like they don't make movies like this anymore. They just wouldn't in our current climate, both from a filmmaking perspective, from a writing perspective, from to every perspective. I feel like if you looked up like a word that is very, very overused and I'm guilty of it is epic. And I feel like, but this is what I mean when I say it, this kind of movie, and not just in the visual scope, because it is beyond epic in that sense, but in the journey. And I don't want to say hero's journey, because that's not what it is. And I'm not sure he qualifies as an anti-hero either, but it's still that journey of a person who is so flawed and yet so interesting and so relatable in ways that sometimes you don't even want to admit to yourself. Therefore, it's just so riveting to me. And I feel like that kind of a character, especially given that he was a real person, and I, you know, I'm not the first person to say, but truth is stranger than fiction so often. And it's one of the reasons I love historical biopic pictures like this that shine a light and really dig in and examine something and maybe doesn't come away with answers, but it does make you think over and over and come back to over and over. And like John said, that's a testament of the best films, is every time you're going back, you're seeing something a little different. Plus, if you wait years, you're older. And so now you see something different when you watch it again. And it's just all of these moving pieces in one film that, you know, I wish more movies would, you know, be as intelligent and be as willing to dive into the gray areas and show us something that, you know, is as moving as it is funny, as it is enjoyable. Like it has everything for me, I guess is the best way to say it.
It's funny. I've been sitting here. I always make the other people say final thoughts first. It's one of my cheats.
You're cheating.
It is definitely a cheat. And I'm having trouble coming up with what mine are. Yeah. The first thought I have is that today when movies are made, if you're going to make, they make some really big movies mm-hmm. with big budgets and big scope. And those movies tend to need to limit what they're about and their complexity and their mystery mm-hmm. and their subtlety and their personalness because they want to appeal to a big audience. Yeah. And there are movies that are deeply personal and subtle and complex and delve into the life of someone, but those movies tend to be really small because they're just like an independent film that goes at a certain place. And this is a movie that is huge in scope mm-hmm. and deeply, deeply intimate and personal. In a way, I can't think of any other epic, which I agree this is an epic. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any other epic that really does this in that at this level. And the thing that it does to me is I get pulled in so completely to the character of T.E. Lawrence. And I like him so much and admire him so much and feel for him so much and am amused by him and his childlike elements and his brilliance and his manipulation and his courage and in the driven qualities of him. I just am swept up with him in this way that I'm not with any other character I can think of in film. And then to see what he goes through and to go through it with him is so painful. And it doesn't leave you with answers. Like it doesn't say, and you know, it doesn't say that he shouldn't have done what he shouldn't have attacked Aqaba. It doesn't say that it wasn't good that he got his men to Damascus. It just says, look at the cost. And the cost exists on a broad level as we see, you know, the murder of the Turkish column or the Turkish hospital. But it also is more importantly, the profound cost on a personal level. And this relates again to, you know, as you said, John, many times, every time you look at a film, you can look at it with new eyes. And now looking at it, I think about soldiers who come back mm-hmm. and what they're dealing with and that yeah. and T.E. Lawrence and what his life was is a cautionary tale for that. And the other thing about some movies, you see the movie and you go, I'm done. And I had a great time and that was awesome or that was really funny or that was really scary or I even cried, mm-hmm. but then you're done with that. And other movies pull you to keep asking questions. And Lawrence, for years, has pulled me to read other books about him, to mm-hmm. study the history about him. And as much as I never get to the end of the character of T.E. Lawrence in the film, I've never gotten to the end or the bottom of the real T.E. Lawrence as he lived in life. They're not knowable things. And maybe that's part of what makes this film so profound for me is that I'm never going to get to the end of it.
Yeah.
Which feels that way sometimes because it's really long. But so that's what we think about Lawrence of Arabia. If you've gone this long, I hope you've watched the film and can tell us what you think. If you want to visit us on Facebook at The Cinephile, CINE-FILES, you can watch this on YouTube or iTunes or Stitcher or a whole bunch of other places. Leave your comments on YouTube. Reviews on iTunes are really, really important. Please leave them. If you want to suggest a film for us to do, visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/thecinephiles. If you've listened to all of this and you haven't watched Lawrence of Arabia, buy it on our website. It's cinephiles.net. And as always, you can reach me at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
You guys can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram. And guys, don't forget, guys and girls, don't forget, leave comments on iTunes, leave comments on YouTube, leave comments on Stitcher, Android, wherever you can do it, leave it because it really helps us. It really helps elevate the show and get us out there more and more to more people. You guys know we're not on a large network like some of my other shows. We're doing this like a mom and pop store, and we're scratching.
Which one's the mom and which one's the pop? I'm the mom.
I said like a mom and pop store. No, I'm the irascible teenage kid who keeps leaving at the wrong time and keeps leaving the door open. So those things are really important to us because we want to keep growing, and there are some plans for this year that are going to be really big, and tackling these larger movies are part of it, and we want to achieve even more credibility with our knowledge and with what we can impart to people out there. And if anyone's teaching our... using our podcast to teach in class or whatever, or learning from film,
turn them on to it. We will be happy to record one specifically for your class. Anything that would be interesting to advance the show would be great.
Absolutely.
So, thanks, everyone.
Rachel, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Rachel.
This has been absolutely amazing.
Thank you. I am absolutely thrilled to be a part of this. I am a avid listener to the Cinephiles, love talking about movies. And when John even remotely suggested that you guys be willing to have me on for this movie in particular, I was like, anytime, any place.
Well, it's been awesome. If people want to reach you on Twitter, where might they find you?
My Twitter handle and Instagram handle is Rachel J. Cushing. Please reach out.
And I think that is it for our epic three-part exploration of Lawrence of Arabia. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.